I'm Bill Giddings from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, where I teach environmental science. And today's title is The Ozone Layer, The Sky is Leaking. And I'm not referring to the kind of leaking we can feel out there today, but something that's farther out, as it were. And I'd like to give credit for my opening paragraph to my daughter Laura, who did a research report on this subject as part of her internship from Harvard Divinity School, for which she was working at the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility in New York City, preparing position papers so that concerned Christians who want to have their faith translate into economic and political action will have some clues as to how to carry that out. And that's perhaps the justification for doing these sessions at Holden Village as well. In the late 1920s, General Motors Frigidaire unit had a product image problem. Refrigerants in use at the time were highly toxic and sometimes explosive, and proud homeowners with electricity were balking at purchasing refrigerators that could kill them if a seal or gasket failed. The solution, developed jointly with DuPont and subsequently put to use by many companies in a wide variety of applications, was the use of CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons. However, in solving Frigidaire's problem, scientists unwittingly created one of much greater proportions, the depletion of the stratospheric ozone layer. And the most recent information on that is that 3 years out of the past four, virtually all of the ozone at the base of the stratosphere in the Antarctic has disappeared as the sunlight reappears in their spring. That similar effects, although much less severe, are found in the Arctic, and that indeed over northern mid-latitudes, roughly between here and New Orleans, ozone is being lost at the rate of 4 to 5% per decade. In the winter months, as high as 8% per decade. In the United States alone, the Environmental Protection Agency estimates that the result of that may be 200,000 additional deaths from skin cancer over the next 50 years. So it is a problem that is to be taken seriously. Now, what's the nature of the problem? We have to understand a little bit about what's going on in the air above us. And if we just draw ourselves a picture where along this direction is the average temperature, and this direction is up.
Thank you, Bill.
Thought we needed to get that straight. Then we know that as we go up in elevation, what does the temperature do? It goes down. The snow is always on the top of the peaks, even if it doesn't feel like it's freezing down here in the village. And that's true up to a point, maybe 7 miles or so. Then that change stops, actually turns around, and it gets warmer for a while. Again, up to a point, and then it starts getting cooler. And our concern today is with this layer defined by the temperature going up as you go up instead of going down. It's called the stratosphere because the atmosphere is stratified into layers. And the reason that that happens is because of the presence of oxygen and sunlight. Up here from the sun comes ultraviolet light. We can't see it, but it can affect us in many ways. And one thing it can do is rip apart the molecules of oxygen in the air. Now, not all of them, just a few of them, but then they come back together in a different way to form ozone. And then down in the lower reaches of the stratosphere, the ozone molecules themselves soak up other ultraviolet light, split apart, and come back together again. And the net result of that, you still have ozone, but heat is released. The ultraviolet light gets changed into heat, and that's what warms up the stratosphere. Well, we don't live up there. We don't depend on it being warm up there. What we depend on is the ultraviolet light not getting down here. Because if it can rip the air molecules apart, it can rip our molecules apart as well. And so it's the presence of that ozone layer that permits life as we know it under the sun down on Earth. Well, over 15 years ago, scientists named Roland and Molina first warned of possible effects of human activity on the ozone layer in the only way humans were to be expected to get up there on the supersonic transport that was under consideration at that time. And that concern of possible damage to the ozone layer was just one of the reasons that led Congress to decide, although we could build one, we're not going to, at least not with the taxpayers' money. But the main attention to the ozone layer then has shifted to what we call the chlorofluorocarbons. Chemists like to draw pictures, and we picture particular atoms according to their initials. C is for carbon, and in these molecules, those carbons are joined together with chlorine atoms and with fluorine atoms to form these marvelous products that make good refrigerators that don't kill you if they spring a leak, and other things we'll be talking about later. And as long as these are the only elements in the molecule, another of their wonderful properties is that nothing happens to them if they do get out in the air. Now, all sorts of things happen in the air to give Los Angeles type smog and so forth. But these things, because of their fluorine, are so stable that none of these processes affect them at all. So all they do is bounce around in the air for years and years and years, and eventually bounce on up into the stratosphere. They don't go up there like a balloon with the hot air from here, because as the temperature gets warmer there, it's like a permanent lid between the two. All the weather is down here. All the atmospheric chemistry that goes along with air pollution is down here. The ozone is up there. But if those get up there, where the ultraviolet light is, then the ultraviolet light can rip off this chlorine atom, and that chlorine atom can destroy an ozone molecule. What it produces in destroying an ozone molecule prevents another ozone molecule from getting back together again in this process of converting ultraviolet light to heat. And then the chlorine atom is let loose to do the same thing over and over again. It can do in 100,000 ozone molecules before something else happens to it to take it out of this cycle. So, first of all, it has to get there to do the damage. The only way it can do that is being so stable that it will survive for years in the atmosphere till it gets up there. Secondly, it has to absorb the ultraviolet light and turn into something reactive, or it can't do the ozone any problem. Well, this was a hypothesis, an educated guess back in 1974, and computer models, deliberate oversimplifications to try to get a handle on what might happen, said yes, this looked like it was plausible. Since then, not only have much better computer models been developed, but a lot of observations have been made. Balloons and high-flying aircraft have gone up there and found the compounds containing chlorine are, in fact, up there where they're expected to be. And the rates of chemical reaction have been measured and found to be in accordance with what seems to be going on up there experimentally. And so it was considered, even by 1980, that it was a serious enough problem to take some action. Back at that time, one of the major uses for these chlorofluorocarbons was to give the push to get the spray out of the spray cans for products like hairspray, deodorant, bug repellent, paint. Anything that came in a spray can probably had chlorofluorocarbons, because remember, they don't react with anything else. They don't cause any problems in the can. They don't poison you if you breathe them. They don't cause any problems down here. The problems are years later up there. So, the United States, Canada, Scandinavia banned all use of those chlorofluorocarbons in regular consumer products. 10 years ago, other countries in Europe had not taken that step at that time. But that's just one of the uses, which no longer is a major one here, is significant in other parts of the world. They're used to make the bubbles in plastic foams. They were used in styrofoam cups, in still used in polyurethane foams, which are used for cushions and furniture and all kinds of things of that sort. I'm probably sitting on some now, since I've got one of the padded cushions here. They're used in insulation. Insulation for houses, insulation for refrigerators, because they have such good properties of absorbing heat. That's what makes them good also for refrigerators and air conditioners, which was what they were developed for, refrigerators in the first place. Various figures running 70% to 90% of the automobiles sold in the United States have air conditioners in them. That's what people want. 3/4 of the food eaten in the United States is refrigerated at some point before it's bought. And chlorofluorocarbons are all that is being used at this point for those operations, as well as household and commercial air conditioning. There's a $750 million a year market for the chlorofluorocarbons. They're required for use in a $28 billion worth of goods like refrigerators and air conditioners, and services like eating foods or watching movies in cool comfort. And the end-use value of all of the equipment for doing this is on the order of $135 billion, so this is not something to be interfered with lightly. Similar compounds that have similar effects on the ozone layer are used in fire extinguishers called halon fire extinguishers. They're the safest and the most effective. They aren't toxic. They don't leave any mess. They put out fires the best. The Coast Guard requires them to be used on commercial boats. So these are very important to us as far as what they can do for us. Now, the interest in the problem leaked up again in the year 1985 when the ozone hole was first reported over the South Pole, and apparently had been appearing every year since 1977, but nobody had noticed it. People had been measuring the amount of ozone in the air, both from the ground, by the way the ultraviolet light could get through the air, and from satellites looking down the other direction. But the satellite was programmed so that if the value was below a certain level, it said ignore it, there must be something wrong with the instrument. Well, that wasn't the case. There was something wrong with the ozone layer. but it was several years later before anybody noticed. And it was one of the groups looking up from the ground that refused to ignore what the instruments were telling them and turned out to be correct. Now, none of the computer models had predicted that anything that dramatic could possibly happen anywhere near that soon. They're talking more about what's going to happen 50, 100 years in the future. Since then, experiments and studies have shown that a variety of factors are necessary for that ozone hole to appear. First of all, extremely low temperatures, and that's why it's over Antarctica much more severely than over the North Pole, because it gets colder down there, something like 120 degrees below zero. That not only freezes out the water vapor, what is little is in the stratosphere, but it also freezes out nitric acid there onto the ice crystals, and it freezes out all the compounds, natural or artificial, that contain chlorine that get up there. And so it also creates a polar vortex, a large-scale whirlwind, that isolates this coldest part from all the rest of the Earth's atmosphere during the winter period of time. Then the sun rises in the spring, things begin to warm up a bit, that whirlwind breaks apart, things begin to spread out, and the ice melts, and the ozone chewing up chlorine compounds are released and start chomping away for 5 to 6 weeks. Now, that hole does vary from year to year, but 3 out of the last 4 years it's been, as I said, so severe that in certain places at the bottom of the stratosphere, virtually all of the ozone is gone for a while. And the ultraviolet light that gets through has been shown to be increasing not only in Antarctica, but also in Australia and New Zealand. And people on the beaches in Argentina are complaining they're getting worse sunburns than they used to. Well, that begins to say what the problem is. Skin cancer, I already mentioned. Besides the ultraviolet light producing the tan, the wrinkles, the leathery skin, every 1% drop in the ozone may lead to anywhere from a 2 to 6% increase in skin cancers. Now, that's especially true, of course, for us light-colored folks.
Bill, has that been absolutely proven, or is it just, a coincidence of percentages?
Well, it's been demonstrated conclusively that more ultraviolet light gives more skin cancer. Okay. As to how many skin cancers can be blamed by now, how much of the five-fold increase in deaths from skin cancer in Australia over the past 50 years actually result from the ozone layer, that
that part would be questionable prove. Because there may be other reasons why people may have been more exposed to the ultraviolet rays.
Right.
But it's clearly been shown that there's a relationship between ultraviolet exposure and skin cancer.
Yes, there's no doubt about that one. And most of the skin cancers are easily treated if they're detected, but the kind called melanoma do kill 8,000 a year in the U.S. alone, and they project many more deaths. Again, this is just projection, not something that the word proof could possibly apply to. Now, another effect of the ultraviolet light is on cataracts, and there's no race that has protection against cataracts the way some races have more protection of the skin than others. And so they expect 1 to a few million more cataracts in the U.S. over a period of time as a result of more ultraviolet light. And of course, the majority of the world's population don't have the option of going and having cataract surgery. It's simply not available to them as it is to us. There are also concerns about the possible effects of ultraviolet light on our immune system. Some animal experiments have indicated that more ultraviolet means lower resistance to infection, to tumors, and to parasites, but the connection hasn't been made conclusively with humans. Yes.
Going back to the cataracts. You know, now when you try to buy sunglasses, they all have all sorts of comments on the UVA and UVP. Mm-hmm. Right? What exactly are you supposed to be doing to protect your eyes?
Well, if you wear sunglasses that have the kind of coating that absorbs ultraviolet. See, we can't see the ultraviolet, so we can't tell by looking at the sunglasses if it has that kind of protection or not. What we see is that it cuts down on the amount of visible light. But of course, if you're wearing dark glasses, then your eyes open wider, and that can let more ultraviolet through if there's not special protection for that as well.
So what would be your recommendation when buying something like that?
Every time I buy a new pair of glasses, I pay the $10 or $15 for the ultraviolet protection, whether I need it or not, because I figure it's good insurance. And with sunglasses, I always buy the Polaroid kind, which are more effective on the visible light. I'm not sure on the ultraviolet that makes any difference. Another concern about more ultraviolet light.
I'm willing to give a commercial for some sunglass corporation.
Well, unwilling to be accused of practicing medicine without a license. Well, there's also concern about effects on plants. They can get sunburned too. Crop yields can be decreased by too much ultraviolet light. Their ability of those crops to make use of water can be reduced. With soybeans, it indicates that to the extent their ozone layer is decreased, so is the soybean yield. And if you add more fertilizer to compensate for that, then you make the soybeans more sensitive to ultraviolet than they are with less fertilizer. And there's real concern for the creatures that live in the water, from the phytoplankton, the tiny plants that are at the base of the food chain on the edges of Antarctica. Their productivity is reduced as the ozone layer is reduced, and the krill that eat them and in turn are eaten by everything up to the whales. These are, as I say, concerns, not things where definite convincing connections have been made. Then materials get damaged by ultraviolet light, that if the ozone decreases, then potentially billions of dollars of extra damage to plastic materials may result, for example, and the smog cycle can get worse also. As far as the economics are concerned, for this one, the estimates are that the benefits of paying the money to help control the problem will be 100 times or more greater than what it will cost to control it. And that kind of economic advantage to doing something is not often found at this stage of the argument. So, what should be done about it? In 1985, delegates from many of the industrial countries, there was a slip, of the world met in Vienna to discuss protection of the ozone layer. The outcome of that was what's called the Montreal Protocol, because that's where it was agreed upon in 1987. It was signed by 46 countries on the spot. It's been ratified by the United States, Japan, the entire European Economic Community, and 50-some countries altogether. And they agreed that of the five different chlorofluorocarbons, there's a lot of variety within the molecules as to how many carbons, how many chlorines, how many fluorines, but the five that do the most damage to the ozone layer would be held at their 1986 level of production and cut ultimately 50% by 1998. Now, this was a very encouraging example of international cooperation on environmental problems. Unfortunately, it was very soon found it wasn't enough to do the job. that even if everyone followed that convention, that things would get five times as bad by the year 2100 as they are now. And so since that time, in fact, just last summer, 93 nations approved an agreement in London that they would quit making chlorofluorocarbons entirely within the next 10 years. Absolutely stop. And countries that went along with that, that hadn't gone along with the other, included China and India, which between them have over a third of the world's population. They'd refused to sign the other one because they said that it would hurt them too much. China, for example, is hoping to extend the benefits of household refrigerators from the 10% of their population that has them now to hopefully 100% within that time frame. They're already one of the largest manufacturers of refrigerators in the world. But what made the difference so that they're willing to sign this more severe agreement is two things. One, those countries are given 10 more years to phase it out. They don't have to phase it out until 2010, whereas the rest of us that use the most of it now have to phase out completely by 2000. And secondly, there's a little matter of $240 million for technical assistance given by the industrial companies to the developing companies to help them phase out. And the United States has, in fact, agreed to contribute to that after some considerable reluctance.
You said companies again. You still mean countries.
I still mean countries. Okay. I'm sorry. The developing countries now consume 15% of the world's production, but are expected to produce more. Well, what are we going to do instead? We'll have to use something else to do what we will still have to do. And, of course, what else we use, first place, may not be available right now. So that's why 10 years has to be given at least to phase these out completely. Secondly, even if you find something else you can use, you've got to test it and see how well it works, and you can't expect it will necessarily work as well. Third, you've got to test and see how safe it is, and that takes several years to get new products approved for consumer use. But DuPont and others of the world's largest producer of chlorofluorocarbons had already announced they would quit producing them by 2000 before the agreement was even signed. And they've got some things in mind to use after those are not available. These are abbreviated CFCs. They're the ones we're going to get rid of entirely. HCFCs are the first substitutes online, and what that means is that somewhere in this molecule there is also a hydrogen atom. The difference that makes is that the presence of that hydrogen atom means that these will mostly get chewed up down here, and only 5 to 10% at worst will ever get up in the stratosphere to do the damage. But the agreement is that within 50 years, all these are going to be phased out as well, because that 5 to 10% is more than we should expect to live with forever. But the 50 years is kind of a compromise between those that say 5 or 10% is too much, let's ban those right now, and the companies that say there isn't anything else we've got available to use, and besides, it's going to cost billions of dollars to switch to these to make things 90 to 95% better, and got to give us time to recoup that investment before we do away with that entirely. They have nothing in them but carbon, hydrogen, and fluorine. And so they do get up in the stratosphere, there's no chlorine there to get ripped off to do the damage. They cannot damage the ozone layer, but they can't do the jobs of the CFCs right now, and they will be much more difficult and expensive to make, and there are a number of kinds of questions.
Bill, this may be just really an obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Please do.
You said that the HCFCs get chewed up for the most part before mm-hmm. they would reach the stratosphere.
Right.
I assume people have been checking out to see what kind of damage they may add to our situation as they're being chewed up before they go into the stratosphere. I mean,
yeah.
This is always my fear.
Yeah.
We go to something new, we don't see all the implications of it, and in the end, it may not really be a better solution than what we're trying to replace.
That is the risk. And they're looking at it, but again, they've been producing the CFCs since 1920s before anybody had any idea they were causing any kind of a problem at all. And that's true. There's
so there's never
that
any way to know everything.
That's right.
To put it in simple.
And you don't go to the trouble of looking until you have a reason to.
Yeah, that's true too.
And somebody, 'cause somebody has to pay for doing that.
Right.
So it turns out that of the various activities now in the United States that let CFCs loose in the air, it's the automobile air conditioner that contributes by far the most. For one thing, as they're now produced, they contain about 3 pounds of the CFCs as compared to a few ounces in your refrigerator, because they're made with enough cooling power to cool a medium-sized house, just so that your car can get cooled down in a few minutes from sitting out in the hot sun for a few hours. Now, they have actually, bypassing the 90% as bad, better ones, they have an HCF product in mind. The problem is, it won't work as well. And so you can't just put that into your air conditioner in your car now in place of it. It won't work at all. You'll have to have a different air conditioner, and you'll have to have a bigger one, or, of course, do with less cooling, and pay 3 to 5 times more because it's much more difficult to manufacture. Already, things have changed. The last time I had my air conditioner serviced in my car, I found myself paying over $21 for the CFC to recharge it, plus another $22 for installation. By that time, they had changed the process of recharging it. They used to just let it open up and maybe 70% would still be there. They'd let all that loose and then they'd shove a charge through to purge all the air out, and then they'd put another charge in for you to use. Now, by law in the state of Washington, and I think this will be part of the implementation of the Clean Air Act that Congress passed, so it will be nationwide, that must be recovered, collected, reused. And so that's one thing that it will be changing, is that maybe up to a third of the CFCs we now use will end up being recycled and reused rather than being let loose in the air. And since they're already manufactured, they will not contribute more to the problem than already has been contributed.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of a machine that could be made that just sucks air in and gathers up the chlorine molecules right out of it?
From where? The whole atmosphere?
Right out of the atmosphere, yeah. I mean, if they're bouncing around down here and...
Yeah, but they're here in such small amounts compared to the rest of the air
that
it would be hard to imagine being able to pick them out of all the rest of the stuff.
Yeah. There isn't anything that attracts them that's down here, is there?
No, that was one of the beauties
yeah.
of them until they found out what the problem was. So for new refrigerators, for air conditioners, for new cars, and of course the car manufacturers have to settle on the dimensions of these things about 4 years before the cars are in the showroom. And to make a change any quicker than that is virtually impossible. But the new ones will use the new materials. And as a result, the amount of CFCs produced will start down. In fact, by U.S. law, it's got to be cut some 15% this year compared to last year, which of course drives the price up, which also drives the usage down. As far,
if you're not running your air conditioner in your car at this point, making a difference? I mean, is it leaking out of some place in your car?
Well, I don't really know how much faster it leaks, if any, when you use it compared to when you don't use it. You're advised to turn it on at least once a month to keep it in good operating condition. Mm-hmm. So the advice I'd give is you don't get the air conditioner serviced unnecessarily, as long as it still works and still cools the car. The way you can tell if it's leaked is that if you can turn it on and it runs but it doesn't cool, then too much of the stuff is leaked out. And then when you take it in, very important to have them fix the leak as well as recharge it, and you take it to a place that recovers it, which all Ford and General Motors dealers are doing, and I think everybody legally has to do now in this state, but not necessarily in every state.
So driving your vehicle and not running your air conditioner during the summer months is kind of a moot point if you've already got it in there anyway?
That's the way I see it.
What if you leave your air conditioner dead?
You what?
What if you leave it dead? Don't get it going again. Just drive the car without the air conditioner.
Well, if you are going to refrain from using it entirely, then you really ought to get the thing taken out because it's costing you gasoline to carry that extra weight around. That doesn't do you any good. Of course, it costs more gasoline to actually use it.
This might be a dumb question, but why do you have to get that replaced? I mean, does it get dirty like a coupe?
It leaks out.
It disappears.
Oh,
just okay. Leaks out into the air. Now your refrigerator.
I have an air conditioner in my car.
Yeah, your refrigerator doesn't do that. At least not nearly as fast. Something about the way the automobile air conditioners are made, and partly I guess it's their great size compared to your refrigerator that makes them much more prone to leak. Other substitutions are being made in the polyurethane foam business. They expect that within a couple more years that 60% less will be used as other bubbling agents get produced to take their place. As far as the styrofoam cups and the plates and so forth that are used in the clamshells for the hamburgers, chlorofluorocarbons have not been used in those since 1988. The industry had voluntarily decided it was in their interest to quit doing that for public relations purposes as well as social benefit. And so that is no longer the case that chlorofluorocarbons are used in your styrofoam cup. Your new styrofoam cup will damage the ozone layer the way the old one would. However, what they're using are the HCFCs, so whether 5 to 10% is too bad or not is something that different people have different points of view on. For the fire extinguishers, there's a real problem because the advantages that the halons have is that they aren't poisonous they're clean, they don't leave a mess, and they're highly effective in putting out the fire. And then you need to add to that a fourth criterion they can't meet, which is a low or zero potential for destroying ozone. And they haven't found anything that has all four of those characteristics, but they're working on it. But there'll have to be some trade-offs in the meantime, and what they find will be more expensive and require more of it to do the job, probably, because it won't be as effective. Well, as far as our own responsibilities in the matter, I'd like to share with you Laura's advice. What are the implications of these dilemmas for environmental activists? One thing seems clear: the sooner halocarbons are eliminated, the better it will be for the planet. Any legislative or other measures designed to encourage movement in that direction should be supported, and there have been some very significant ones in the past year. However, it is also important to examine the alternatives being presented, exactly what Nancy was saying. Are the EPA toxicity tests sufficient to determine long-term effects? And these tests do take 2 to 5 years. Will the alternatives contribute to global warming? Now, that's another aspect of chlorofluorocarbons that I talked about yesterday. They are very efficient at heat transfer. That's why they're so good in refrigerators and air conditioners. They're also very efficient in soaking up the heat that the Earth needs to send back out to space in order to keep from warming up as these things get into the air. Now, the substitutes, again, the HCFCs not being in the air for so long, 5 years instead of 50, cannot do near as much of that greenhouse effect soaking up of the heat. Furthermore, the HCFs, at least, although they have some of that effect, they have only a few percent as great an effect per molecule as the things that are going to be phased out. Does their production require using and discarding hazardous chemicals? Again, implicit in your question. Are they less energy efficient? So far, the answer to that is yes. The refrigerator manufacturers are complaining that on the one hand, regulations say that they've got to become 30% more energy efficient. On the other hand, they're saying they can't use the chemicals that make it possible to meet that goal. And someone else had estimated that several hundred million barrels worth of oil per year in the United States, that amount of extra energy will be needed to make up for the loss of the foam insulation using chlorofluorocarbons, because the substitutes won't do the job so well. These are questions that must be addressed to companies, the answers to which will partly determine the better directions to pursue. Most important, we must ask what we can do without. Are there non-chemical alternatives for the use in cleaning circuit boards for electronic equipment? There are two approaches. One is to use a different kind of product entirely that uses water. And the other is they've gone to finding a different kind of solder that doesn't make such a mess that needs cleaning up in the second place. Such as using vacuum sealing rather than CFC propelled foam for insulating. Rather than argue, for example, whether to use styrofoam or paper cups, we need to be concentrating on reusable, washable alternatives. As with many environmental dilemmas, the most progress will be made when we learn how to demand less. And corporate America starts believing we actually mean it. And it was the public's response that led to tremendous drops in the sales of chlorofluorocarbon propellants for spray cans before the law went into effect banning their use. It does make a difference what we are willing to do without or insist upon in what we do buy. As far as other individual suggestions on the table outside the door here in the hall are copies of, the title is On Earth as in Heaven, On Living Toward God's Future, Responses to What the Natural World is Telling Us. The first page deals with citizen action to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and global warming trends. The second page has citizen action regarding wastes, and I'll be doing a couple of sessions on wastes and what we do with them next week. And then there are suggestions 85 through 94 are for citizen action regarding ozone depletion. And then it also considers water and economic practice and other things that I'm not able to get into.
And this is available right out here on the table.
Right out here on the table in the hallway. Well, it says only purchase aerosol products that provide information about the propellant as something other than a chlorofluorocarbon. There are a few special cases where chlorofluorocarbon propellants are still used, although not in the most ordinary consumer products. He says not to use styrofoam products. Again, you can take the point of view that 5 or 10% is too much, and it is the HCFCs that are used in those, and that other kinds of insulation also are available for picnic coolers and packing materials and houses and so forth. Do not buy halon fire extinguishers having bromine contents. If it's halon, it does have the content that does the damage. I'm not sure what the alternatives are. When your air conditioner needs attention, get it fixed immediately. And then I say, but don't get it fixed if it doesn't seem to need attention. At a repair establishment that has a policy of collecting and recycling the CFC coolant. Join an environmental group working to secure government action to ban use of CFCs. That's already been effective. Participate in campaigns to bring the issue to the attention of your representatives. Help initiate programs of education in churches, schools, and clubs. I'm trying to do that. Join with others to secure newspaper, radio, and television coverage of the issues. Support action to get local governments to collect and recycle refrigerators and air conditioners. Now that's a part of the problem I'm not sure has been addressed effectively. When you get your air conditioner serviced, then, or in this state at least, they have to be careful to collect the material. When you get rid of it entirely, and it's junk, I'm not at all sure that anybody is going to collect the material. Or when your refrigerator is dead and you don't get it serviced, you get rid of it and it ends up being junked, I'm not at all sure anybody is paying any attention to.
What happens to the collected fluids that they collect?
They reuse them again.
Okay.
And so what's going to be banned in the year 2000 isn't the use, it's the production. So reuse will still be possible. There isn't any way really to destroy the stuff. It won't burn, that's why it's so good at some of the things it does, and so reuse seems to be the best thing to do with it.
Can you turn it into something else?
Not effectively, I don't think. Put a substantial amount in your budget to support organizations and to buy materials to have them available for distribution at the drop of a hat. Of course, use this occasion to face the causes of your concern with those involved in your budget. In other words, bug the manufacturers. It's not just not to buy products that have damaging things and damaging results that you don't need, but let them know, and let them know why, and let your friends and neighbors know as well.